You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
I'm American Free Press roving editor Mark Anderson, and today, Monday, May 15, 2017, I'm with Daniel Estulin, a noted Bilderberg author, researcher, and now documentary maker on this nefarious group that's been having these secretive meetings in posh hotels and resorts since 1954. Thanks for being with me, Daniel.
Thank you so much for the invitation. For me, it's always a great honor to be a part of anything related to American Free Press. As you know, Jim Tucker, who died 2 or 3 years ago, I can't remember right now, but he was a great friend of mine. I admired him a lot. His work basically started this whole Bilderberg research for a lot of us, and it's a great way to pay homage to a great man who is no longer with us, but his work certainly is.
Yeah, believe it or not, the fourth anniversary of his death passed in this past April. Yeah, thanks for that, Daniel. Yeah, Jim took me under his wing starting in 2010 for the Spain Bilderberg meeting, where I crossed paths with you for the first time. We met intermittently some other times after that. It's great to have you on the show, and the reason we're doing that for the listeners is that primarily is that Daniel is behind the creation of a new Bilderberg documentary that's going to be presented and given a kind of a advanced screening, unless this is an additional screening, but May 24 in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm penciled in to be there with a couple others, and it's at the Prytania Theater, I believe it's called. And at 7:30 p.m., that'd be Central Time, I think. And Daniel, is this the first showing of this film?
It is in North America. Actually, up until July of last year, I've been living in Europe and Spain for almost a quarter century. I just came back last July, and I'm based now in Toronto, Canada. And it's actually my first, will be my first conference slash presentation slash film premiere of anything of mine in North America in the last, I think, 10 years. So yeah, this is the North American premiere. The film is not out yet. We are doing the festival tour, and I think it will be out in theaters by November or early December of this year.
How long is it? Just how much depth do you get into?
The film is 62 minutes long. We cover a lot of ground. Actually, we started working on this film about 2011, 2012, when a very well-known Spanish producer who was a big fan of my work approached me about making a documentary, and we signed a deal. And to make a long story short, or the first part of the story short, is that 6 months later he was ruined, and he lost all his money. The banks, if you believe in conspiracy or coincidence theories, three banks called in his loans at the same time, and he basically went bankrupt. Then another year went by. And this other group of people actually decided to make a film, and I was the co-producer on the film. And the film was done I think it was late summer of 2015. And then one day my co-producer comes to me and says that he sold his 50% stake in the film to Baker & Taylor. That's a subsidiary of the Carlyle Group. Again, if you believe the coincidence of the conspiracy theory. So I basically knew that, these people own half of the negative. There would be no way to get the film out. It was sabotaged because, again, Carlyle doesn't need the money, nor are they particularly interested in releasing a film on the Bilderberg Group. And, of course, the Carlyles are the Bushes, the Bin Ladens, the Bakers, and so on and so forth. So it's, again, goes to show you how, power structures, work beyond and above the governmental levels. And so basically what I decided to do after 2.5 years of making this film slowly but surely is I was a script writer on the film. Most of the images, documentary footages was, mine as well. So what I needed to do was to reshoot all the interviews. That would be the only way to actually assure that the film would be 100% mine. So that's what I did. And what we initially took us about 2 years of interviews, painstaking interviews in 13 cities, in 11 countries, in three continents, I had to reshoot very quickly in about 2 months. And this was one of the only ways I could assure that the film would be 100% mine. We did that, and it was finally released or ready for release about 6 months ago. So now we're ready to go again. It's 100% my film, produced by me. So there's no Bilderbergers, no Carlyle Groups, no Bin Ladens involved in the production of this film.
Wow. And again, ladies and gentlemen, Wednesday, May 24, 2017, the venue, the Prytania Theater at 5339. That's 5339 Prytania Street, New Orleans, Louisiana. It's $50. That includes the movie. You get a book. You get refreshments. There's a kind of an interview Q&A session. And it looks like it's going to be a great thing. And I'll be following through on that even as I'm reporting on it now. With this podcast and in writing in advance of the event. And maybe, Daniel, later toward the end, though, you could share a phone number or something for those interested.
Absolutely. You know, it's something else, Mark. I mean, that's like people, I've had a few calls, people saying, wow, it's a bit expensive. This film cost me personally almost $200,000, American dollars. We shot on location in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, in England, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in the United States, in Canada. In several countries in Latin America, in Russia, and I'm missing some. It's 11 countries, 13 cities. Music is original, footage is original, everything is original. None of it is, based on the images you can buy or just download from the internet. So again, it's $200,000 production, first real documentary. There's a lot of stuff out there on YouTube, but when I decided to make this film, my question was like, you know, would people want to see another film on the Bilderbergers, considering there's just so much stuff out there, you know, dealing with the aliens, dealing with, you know, extraterrestrials, dealing with lizard people, Bilderbergers, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's like, it's not a criticism of anyone else's work. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that my question was, do I want to get into this, spend all this money and time? Because again, it's 2.5, almost 3 years of painstakingly putting this whole thing together. Actually, to get something out there that people are not going to see, they're going to say, well, it's just another film on the Bilderberg Group. And then I thought to myself, you know, my book, Jim Tucker did a great book on the Bilderbergers, but my book was published in 68 countries, has been translated
languages. So when people kind of, you know, think of Bilderberg, they think of Jim's work and they also think of my work. And because my book has been out in so many different countries, and I was lucky enough, you know, to have it first published by the third biggest publisher in the world in Spain, Planeta. And the reason they got into this, I think, in the first place, because the guy was the owner of Planeta. He kind of looked at it as a different line of business. You know what I mean? So, and he wasn't going to be pressured by, you know, powers that be to not publish the book, although he was. And so in the end,
and I thought to myself that people would use that, the fact that, you know, the book itself was written by me as a reference point, and point of departure, to see the film. And there's a lot of stuff in the film which is new and explains Bilderberg from a, you know, perception and perspective of an investigative journalist and a former intelligence officer, which is what, you know, my background is all about.
Yes. You said you came out of some intelligence work. Briefly, what was that?
I spent, over a decade, almost 15 years in military counterintelligence and a Russian military counterintelligence. And, you know, the fact is that Russians have always been interested in Bilderberg organizations going back to the late 1940s, early 1950s. In the time of, you know, the rise of Atlanticism, you know, the culmination of, you know, of, yes, NATO creation, transatlantic power structures at the end of the World War II. So again, Bilderberg was of great interest and concern to them, and they've been following arduously all the early Bilderberg meetings, 1954, 55, and in fact, in the Soviet archives, there's a lot of information painstakingly put together by the Russian intelligence, KGB, and other organizations as well, dealing with the individuals involved in the early Bilderberg meetings from the early 1950s. And again, the first one was held at the Bilderberger Hotel in the Netherlands on the outskirts of Amsterdam, in this little town called Oosterbeek. And the hotel itself is called the Bilderberger Hotel, which is why, again, it's the reason they're called the Bilderbergers and not the best Western hotel. The fact that, imagine what kind of a title that would be, you know, this true story of the best Western hotel club. You know, so again, the Bilderberg conspiracy or a conference, it's a kind of an annual private invitations only meeting of about 120 to 150 people of the European and North American political elite, in conjunction with, you know, leaders in the industry, finance, academia, media. And although it brings together some of the globe's most powerful people every year, the group, up to you know, about 10, 12 years ago, was able to remain almost completely secretive. It's not a secret society, okay? It's a private organization. And now very little information came out. And that's one of the things that Jim Tucker talked about early on. He, being a seasoned reporter, you know, based in Washington, he didn't know anything about these people until, you know, 30, 40 years after the meetings first, you know, took place.
Correct.
So it's supposed to show you how secretive these people are. But again, rather than, you know, being a totally homogenous group, the Bilderberg meetings, they're organized around the principle of reaching consensus instead of through voting and formal resolutions. Nobody tells anyone what to do. No one threatens anyone. But again, it's, you're looking at the former NATO alliance, Western Europe, Canada, the United States. That's why it's called, you know, the Bilderberg. You have other organizations such as the Trilateral Commission, which is this other private organization founded back in the 1970s, 73 to be exact, by David Rockefeller and it was Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter, which is America's Europe and Asia. That's Trilateral. Then you have Council on Foreign Relations, which was founded in the, you know, early 20s. That's the kind of the American version of the round table, Cecil Rhodes round table.
Right.
And you're looking, again, and what you're looking at is a lot of these organizations, the way they work together and the way they're put together. You have a European organization such as, you know, the Pernai Circle, for example. Then you have the Bohemian Grove in the United States. And the way that these societies work, again, they're based on the idea of the needs of the capitalist system. Because when you're looking at capitalism, you're looking at, you know, a trilateral system. You have the government, you have the money, you have supranational structures which are run by these societies. And again, if you're looking at capitalism economically, okay, it's a worldwide global system without borders. But politically, beginning in 1648 with, you know, with the Peace of Westphalia, it's not a unified market, but rather a puzzle of, you know, independent sovereign pieces. So it's capital versus the government. And in this system, you need supranational interests who can actually look after the capital on the global stage. And that's why these private organizations, beginning with Masonry, were created in the first place. And over time, Masonry developed into other societies and private organizations. And that's how the Bilderberg, CFR, Trilateral Commission, that's how all these societies over the last 200 years, you know, got going. Because again, you know, the capitalist system itself needed power structures that work globally together in different countries, you know, to push their interests forward. So it's not a conspiracy per se, where you have, you know, four old geezers sitting in a dark room holding hands, staring at a crystal ball, planning the world's domination. It doesn't really work that way. It's important to understand that it's not some kind of, you know, wacky conspiracy theory put together by, you know, extreme right wing, which is how, you know, the elitist right would like to characterize American Free Press, you know, Jim Tucker's work and other people's work as well, who, you know, who actually look closely at these societies. But again, just to give you an idea, the KGB was very interested about, you know, the Bilderbergers way back in the late 1940s when Stalin was still alive. And before it was called Bilderberg, needless to say. And, you know, when the whole thing got started in 54, Stalin was already dead. But the system itself was what, you know, really was of great concern to the Russians or the Soviets at the time, how, you know, the whole thing was put together. And if you kind of look and study the first five Bilderberg conferences, for example, Mark, you know, they played a decisive role in the lead up to signing of the Treaty of Rome, the, you know, recognized by the European Union itself as a kind of formative event that lies at its foundations. And during these meetings, for example, protectionism was successfully subordinated to the liberalization or liberalizing idea of a common markets. And documents leaked by, you know, WikiLeaks, for example, show that there was a general recognition of the pressing need to bring the German people together with other people in Europe into a common market, you know, among the Bilderbergers at its third conference back in September 1955. And it was generally recognized that it is, you know, in their common interest and responsibility to arrive at the shortest possible time at the highest degree of integration, you know, beginning with a common European market. That's what, you know, these people talked about.
Yeah,
so that's what Bilderberg is.
What I want to interject there is Richard J. Aldrich, the scholar out of the UK, and others have outlined that when Joseph Redinger, one of the founders with Prince Bernhard of the Bilderberg Group, when they first kicked things off, they were trying in the post-World War II years, they were trying to reorganize Europe in the way that you're describing, capital over people, capital over sovereign governments. And in so doing, there was some CIA seed money to help Bilderberg get going, according to the UK scholar, Mr. Aldrich.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. In fact, Aldrich is one of the people I interviewed. He's in the documentary. He actually talks about this. I met him. He's a wonderful man. He lives in Amsterdam, and he was part of my initial interviews, so, you know, before the Carlyle Group and Bin Laden's and company decided to, you know, get their dirty, grubby heads on my film. And then after I got rid of them, you know, we interviewed him again. If you kind of go back, you know, to the early 1950s, you know, May 1950, French Foreign Minister at the time, Robert Schuman, he proposed to place Franco-German production of coal and steel under the common supranational high authority with sovereign powers of its own. And basically what followed was, you know, the establishment of the European Coal and Steel Committee between West Germany, France, Italy, and also the Benelux, Belgium, Luxembourg, and the direct predecessor to the European Common Market. And again, the CIA had a role in playing in this thing. And although, you know, this whole thing was called the Schuman Declaration, it was inspired and for the most part drafted by the French diplomat Jean Monnet, which is the first president of the high authority, although he was never really elected to public office. And aside from, you know, his cartoonish textbook description as the idealistic founding father of Europe, which is what you see all over, you know, stamped in all European documents.
Yes.
Monnet was tied into the extensive network of transatlantic connections, spending much of his life in the United States. And not only was he linked to powerful investment banks such as Lazard Frères and Goldman Sachs, both at the time in the Rockefeller orbit, but he also served as President Roosevelt's wartime eyes and ears and personal advisor in Europe. And French President Charles de Gaulle, who blocked for the European integration of France in the 1960s, even conceived of Monnet as an American agent. And again, there's a lot of this interjection between different power circles on how the whole thing was put together. But what's interesting, if you kind of analyze, you know, the entire Bilderberger project, is that there are actually two parts to it. One was the Nazi international part, because one of the reasons Bilderberg was put together and when it was put together back in 1954, but, you know, again, it was organized right after the Second World War. They actually began talking about the idea of Bilderberg before it was called Bilderberg in 1943, was the idea that all this money, all this wealth, which was stolen by the, you know, Third Reich, and it was shipped to South America. Then in 1954, it was actually brought back. And that's the base point of the resurgence of the German miracle, as they call it. It had nothing to do with the German economy or the perseverance of the German people. It had to do with all this wealth being brought back for the establishment of the Fourth Reich, which wasn't Fourth Reich in Germany, but rather through the European Union. That was one aspect of it. That's a very interesting and important aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is the fact that it was a way to fuse the losers and the winners of World War II using, you know, the seed money, not the CIA, but in this case, you know, the world jewelry, okay, the Jews. And again, on the one hand, you had the winners, you had the Anglo-Americans. On the other hand, you had the losers, you had the Italians and the Germany. And, of course, you had the Vatican. They lost the war. And the idea was to get these two sides working together. And as a result of that, you had the creation of what's called, you know, became known as the as the Bilderbergers, and of course we have the Club of Rome and the Treaty of Rome and everything else, which was signed later on. But the whole point of this, you know, ultra-imperialistic, you know, roadmap, you know, which led to the Treaty of Rome, which led to the creation of, you know, of what we now know as the European project, it was put together by some of these key individuals. And you mentioned one of them, of course, one of, you know, key individuals, you know, the project is a Polish politician in exile by the name of Joseph Rettinger, who was a Jesuit, or he studied, you know, in Jesuit schools. He was obviously, you know, Jesuit trained, as was Fidel Castro, okay, who was concerned about the growth of this anti-Americanism in Western Europe. And they basically proposed this international conference at which the Western European and North American elite will be brought together to promote their version of Atlanticism. And, you know, you had the Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, which, of course, the, you know, the consort to Queen Julianne of the Netherlands. He was the face of the Bilderbergers because, you know, he was handsome, he was well-known, he was famous, he was a polemic, and cover all the other transgressions of some of the other individuals. And of course, Prince Bernard, he was a SS Nazi carrying member back in the 1930s, something which was, you know, covered up until way back, you know, until I think it was like the early 1980s when that information finally came out, and a lot of other people. And amongst the important attendees, just to cover what you said, Mark, about the CIA's role in this thing, was the one of the key attendees the first year was Walter Budell Smith, Special Assistant for Psychological Warfare.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and director of the Committee for Free Europe and Radio Free Europe, Charles D. Jackson, the head of the Lehman Brothers, George Ball, and powerful bankers and, you know, oligarchs, you know, such as David Rockefeller. And as I said, the first five conferences dealt with, you know, the whole idea of Treaty of Rome, you know, European integration, and involved a lot of the people which later formed, you know, the key element, the backbone of this whole idea of, you know, Atlanticism and globalism, pan-globalism, which is what Bilderberg, you know, turned into over time.
Let me interject there. A lot of people ask me, what is Bilderberg? What I often tell people is that in the way you're describing it, Daniel, big money, capital, the fact that private banks possess the ability to create money, interest-bearing debt, money becomes, it becomes into existence as debt. It's born as debt. And the big monetary systems of the world and their managers and the old bloodlines, basically Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations, which, as you mentioned, is an offshoot of the Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in England, which is a descendant of the Round Tables. It seems that these groups, with Bilderberg being more or less at the center, form basically another system of government.
Bilderberg, I wouldn't call Bilderberg being in the center. It's just one of the lesser nodes. I mean, it was...
Maybe more secretive is a way of looking at it. What I mean is it's something important because it's far lesser known, although, like you say, not unknown. It's a private organization. It's not so ultra-secretive like it used to be. But it seems like big capital needed a governance. You know, they use that word governance, not government, but governance. It seems like they needed a governance system of their own running in parallel to what we think of as the normal governmental systems, and that the Bilderberg and the other groups comprise a network that you could call another system of governance or government for big capital that runs alongside regular government but also collaborates with conventional government when they need military assets, when they need the kinds of things that sovereign governments can provide. That's the way I explain it to people, that this is the way big finance governs itself through these groups.
No, I think it's a very good explanation. I mean, it's in a nutshell, it's what it is. Of course, you have, you know, supranational. Anybody who thinks that, you know, presidents preside over anything is, you really don't understand how things work on the world stage. And you can say the same thing. And, you know, at the conference, we'll be talking, the conference, my film premiere afterwards, we'll be talking about, you know, this whole thing about Clinton and Trump, you know, why, you know, he is, why Trump won the elections. And you know, the whole thing, you know, behind the individuals behind Donald Trump. And again, it all goes back to the fact that, you know, the current economic model, which is based on war, you know, the central banking warfare model, which has been in place for 500 years since the discovery of America in 1492, that model is dead. It's no longer, you can't have infinite growth in the finite planet. I mean, Karl Marx talked about this a long time ago. And when he actually, you know, asked that question, how are you going to do this in the future if you extrapolate the model itself? Nobody, you know, had the answer. And you have the consequences of this today. So that model is dead. And the people representing Clinton or behind Clinton, you know, the financiers, the bankers, the liberal, you know, moneyed elite, these people, you know, at the end of the road, because, again, their model no longer brings them the benefits. So they needed to create a new system, economic model. And they simply don't have a system in place, okay, because that model is dead. Infinite growth is dead. It doesn't work anymore, okay? So what basically you have is another group of people came in, and that's the Trump group, okay, with Donald Trump as their, you know, visible head, and behind me up. The Rothschilds, you have the European elites represented by the old European aristocracy, such as the House of Sage Coburg, Austro-Hungarian aristocracy, Ottoman nobility. Then you have a city-state such as the City of London. I don't mean London itself, I mean the city, you know, the economic part of it, Hong Kong, which is the world center for money laundering, drugs, intelligence, British-controlled, you know, Venice, which is, again, the remnants of the Venetian black nobility. You have the Rothschilds. And so these are the kinds of people, you know, you have representing or the interests behind Donald Trump. Because again, if you kind of look at the history, and again, you know, to pull back into the, you know, this whole Bilderberg thing, is if you kind of look at the history of these power circles, you know, representing the transnational elite, which are the Clinton group, you can go back to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, you know, the central banking system in the United States, responsible for issuing money. Then, you know, they became almost all powerful in 1944 with the Bretton Woods Agreement. You know, they killed Kennedy. They got rid of Nixon. In 1981, they put their president, which is Reagan, creating Reaganomics in the process, and with it additional capital to pump up the markets in the White House. And then they became all powerful in 1991 when the Soviet Union fell apart. Okay, but also, you know, the whole point is that the transnational elite circles, you can call them World Company Limited, as George Ball did, you know, back in the 1968 Bilderberg meeting in Mont-Tremblant in Canada. It controls world entire financial system without opposition. And paradoxically, at the time of the disappearance of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the transnational capitalist elite begins to lose its grip on power, because again, capitalism needs markets, new markets, to survive. And you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. And you can't sell anything, you know, when the last market, which was the Soviet Union, you know, was taken over. And then in 2000, you have this blowout of the dot-com bubble. In 2008, you have, you know, the Lehman Brothers collapse, and the world economy, you know, was about to implode. In 2012, for the first time in over 100 years, you know, President Obama eliminates all Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan representatives from the White House Economic Council. And in 2014, Obama limits the emission of dollars, arguing there is only enough money to finance the United States economy. And then in 2016, you have the Brexit, which is the Rothschild Group victory, and Donald Trump. Okay, this is the transnational elite circles losing power. So if you really look at it, Mark, okay, it may sound like an anathema what I'm going to say, but actually Donald Trump is the continuation of economic policies of President Barack Obama, you know, second term in power. If you really look at it and understand how the economy works. And of course, what, you know, it brings us to today, and what the Bilderberg is going to be talking about this year is what are they going to do as far as the economic model is concerned, because they don't have a model in place. And what is being actually discussed on the world stage is the destruction and elimination of nation states. In other words, you have Westphalia, which is 1648 until about late 1960s. Call it Global 1.0, as Catherine Austin Fitz, former undersecretary for HUD and housing with George W. Bush administration, calls it Global 1.0. And then in the late 1960s, you have the creation of One World Company Limited corporations that have a lot more power than any government on the planet. Okay, and now we're into, you know, Global 3.0, which is, again, networking economy. So all that is being dismantled as we speak, and a new world is being created. Okay.
So let me stop you there. So you're saying that with this year's Bilderberg meeting, 2017, which initially looked like Virginia, but now we're seeing that's not likely, you're saying that they're right on the cusp, right on the brink of this economic or financial system 3.0. In other words, they've hit a bit of an impasse here, a wall, and they've got to restructure this right now.
Well, it's not only that they hit an impasse, it's the, you know, the model is dead. And they have a very limited time, maybe 6 months, maybe 8 months, maybe but less than a year.
What kind of a model might they go for? In other words,
one of the things that we're looking at, because again, this isn't just something that the Americans are working on, the Europeans, everybody in the world stage is looking at this, you know, trying to create a new model, because again, the central banking warfare model, or, you know, infinite growth debt model is dead. Okay, there are no benefits and it can't work in a finite planet. So they need a new model. Otherwise, you're going to wake up one day, very, very soon, and I mean very soon, and you're going to live in a world of Mad Max or Blade Runner, where everything is going to be closed, banks are not going to work, money is going to disappear, and people are going to, you're going to have barbarians at the gate, you know, and you're going to see how hungry they are. And that's what we're looking at. That's what they understand. The fact that 99% of the population don't understand it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists, and they understand it. They're really scared, because they understand that they can no longer paper it over. It's dead. The system is dead. They need a new system. And so what they're looking at is dismantling of nation states, of independent countries, which was the Westphalian creation back in 1648, and the creation of regional blocks. I don't mean European-style regional blocs, which is a political regional union, rather regional blocs of countries working together purely on economic basis. And for that to work, you need a minimum number of people in order to be able to sell your goods. And the minimum number of people, as far as regional blocs are concerned, from the economic point of view, is 600 million people, which is why there's a lot of different regional blocs that are being discussed right now. For example, one of them will be Canada, the United States, Australia, New York.
Daniel,
and then parts of Mexico.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of
that.
There's
a little, like other parts of Mexico.
Sorry.
Can you hear me?
There's a little bit of a problem on rare occasion with your mic kind of bleeping out very, very briefly and then coming back in. I don't think it's going to be a huge issue. It hasn't been so far. It really just started in earnest right now. I'm just mentioning it very briefly.
Okay, maybe it's just because of the way I was sitting, kind of leaning back in my chair. So what I'm saying is that, you know, without getting into it too much, because I think it's going to be too much for the people, I think what they're doing right now is they're looking seriously at the possibility of dismantling countries and creating regional blocs.
Now, let me interject there, but isn't that exactly the wrong thing to do in a logical, common sense way? Coming from a non-elitist like yourself or me, isn't that the wrong thing to do?
They have no choice. They're in a survival mode. You're looking at the dismantling and destruction of the entire world. You're looking at economic Armageddon. You're looking at the end of the world as we know it. And when as Jack Ma said, when trade stops, war starts. And that's one of the reasons you have the Clinton crowd who are so dead set gung ho on getting wars, because wars, they don't write off debt. They simply write off responsibilities. And so what you're looking at right now is trying to, on the one hand, Trump, who is the enemy of the Clinton liberal crowd. And unfortunately, the liberal crowd, they run the financial system, the world stage. They control the economic system. And Russia, Putin doesn't control it at all. Putin controls foreign policy. The other people control the economy. And they're the enemies of Trump and of Putin. And up until Trump's election, Putin simply couldn't get rid of them, because that would have been a declaration of war against the interests of the liberal moneyed elite. And then you wouldn't have had the sanctions against Russia. They would have cut off access to SWIFT. And that meant, cutting off access, to the money supply of the entire nation. And Putin would have had only one option. That would have been the nuclear option, nuclear war. Okay. So for the first time since the election of Trump on the world stage, Trump is not going to work with the liberal circles or doing what they're doing in the United States to destroy his presidency. But they're also the same people who control, International Monetary Fund, World Bank, European Central Bank, Russian Central Bank, and other central banks on the world stage. So you're looking at a covert war between two elite circles. You can talk about Clinton-Trump, you can talk about Rockefeller versus Rothschilds, or, people above that level. But for the first time in history, they can no longer agree, and solve the issues, by virtue of agreement amongst themselves. Because the system that they represent is dead, and a new system needs to be put in place. And that's why Trump won the elections, and that's why Trump has a very concrete objective. He needs to create a new system, put it in place, make it work, and save the world in a very short period of time. It sounds like a Hollywood film, but unfortunately, it's the reality.
Well, let me interject there. So whatever Donald Trump ought to do right now, you're saying that he's not in alliance with the Bilderberg Group or their satellites.
Trump was never part of the Bilderberg Group, because the Bilderberg is, again, the liberal, moneyed financiers, bankers who represent Clinton.
Okay?
Works for different, paymasters. His paymasters, if the paymasters who represented Clinton are the Rockefellers, the Eastern establishment, Silicon Valley, Hollywood, the coasts, basically. What you have, the people who represent, or who Trump represents, okay, there are people who come from a completely different environment. Again, if you're looking at the people that he represents, you're looking at the European oligarchy, you're looking at the Windsors, the British royal family, a British empire. You're looking at the city states such as Hong Kong, such as Venice, such as Singapore. You're looking at the European aristocracy, as I said before. The House of Sage Coburn, Austro-Hungarian aristocracy, Ottoman nobility. Okay, and on a smaller scale, Trump is supported by U.S. intelligence agencies, with the exception of the CIA and probably the DEA, because, again, The CIA would lose access to the lucrative drug trade, okay, which also would happen to the DEA. But again, there are different groups of people, and they don't work for the same master. And the fact that Trump is a billionaire doesn't mean he's a Bilderberger.
Well, the people that he hired that come from Goldman Sachs, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, others in Trump's cabinet, some people of a populist persuasion are a little dismayed that Trump has so many high money people and not more rank and file people in his. Not saying they're aligned with Bilderberg, but it gets a little ambiguous. He had Peter Thiel, who's on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, meeting with him a couple of times. That may or may not mean anything. I realize that. He's a PayPal founder, Peter Thiel, as many know. A lot of people hearing this might think that they might agree with you, or they might just kind of reserve judgment. Maybe they need to see the film that's coming up in New Orleans. We'll plug that again in a minute. But some people, they see Donald Trump as doing some of the right things, getting us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but they see a lot of ambiguities there, and they wonder about the Goldman Sachs people. Is he really draining the swamp? That doesn't mean...
And this is that, again, when you're talking about, like, high level politics, like that, that high level politics, it's not black and white. You're going to have a lot of shades of gray. You're going to have to make deals with people you don't want to deal with. Because, again, if you're looking at Goldman Sachs, these are the people that have been there for, like, last a long time. They know where the bodies are buried. If you need to re-engineer the economy, you know how to do that, because the people who are doing it are the ones who destroyed it in the first place. So again, he needs these people, not that he wants them, but he needs them. And, there's also a good possibility that making these deals to actually, get into position of power, he needed to include them in the equation, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to win.
That thought has come across my own mind and that of readers and editors with AFP and other people I've spoken with about it. And I appreciate you clarifying that. Of course, the purpose of today's podcast is not to get into that alone. But you do address the Trump factor in your upcoming film showing, correct?
Not as much, because, again, remember that. Because we'll be definitely talking about it in the conference, post-film conference. Because when the film was done, that was like last year. The Donald Trump phenomenon wasn't front and center. But we'll definitely be talking about it in the conference, and we'll tie it into the Bilderberg Group and everything that you and I have been talking about for the past almost hour.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. I got a couple questions for you, and I'm sure you've seen some of this. It's interesting that there's the American Friends of Bilderberg Incorporated, run by James A. Johnson, with whom I'm sure you're familiar. They're actually enrolled under the New York State legal system, the American Friends of Bilderberg, as a charity, which is a very interesting thing. And I wanted to get your take on this. Bear with me just a moment. You've probably seen some of the 990 forms that the American Friends of Bilderberg have to file with the IRS. It's interesting that, and this is recognized by the state of New York as well as the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, this is recognized as a summary of direct charitable activities as a private foundation, the American Friends of Bilderberg Incorporated. Some of those U.S. members are on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, including Marie Kravis and James A. Johnson. And James A. Johnson is this rather obscure attorney. And this is what the American Friends of Bilderberg say about themselves on their 990 form. The entity organizes and sponsors conferences which study and discuss significant problems of the Western Alliance. They're calling that a charity, and the New York State government actually accepts that as a statement of charity, which to me is legally very questionable. But get this, in the same sentence, it adds, the American Friends of Bilderberg also collaborate on the Bilderberg meetings held in Europe and North America. So they're talking about two things here. The entity organizes and sponsors conferences which study and discuss significant Western Alliance problems, and they also collaborate on the Bilderberg meetings. In other words, the American Friends of Bilderberg is sponsoring conferences other than the Bilderberg meetings. And this is interesting. Any hint in your studies as to what those other meetings might be?
I think, again, if you look at, you know, the series of foundations and think tanks, we can talk about any foundation you want. You can talk about, you know, the series of David Rockefeller foundations or finance foundations, be it Ford, be it Carnegie. They're all, you know, under the auspices of the Rockefeller stamp. They all work together and collaborate on a global stage and, you know, in different countries. That's how these people be able to get, you know, their agendas, international agendas forward. Because, again, nobody tells anybody what to do, but they all work together. They all work out their differences. They all iron out how things should be done. And they all work towards a particular objective or goal. And that goal has to do with, in their case, you know, promoting liberal banking, economic, financial, or financier elite interests. Which has very little to do with, you know, make America great again. And that's, again, one of the reasons.
So we don't know exactly what those other conferences of the American Friends of Bilderberg are. I mean, I can take a stab at
it. Yeah. We know what some of these foundations are. We know that they work with them. We know that, you know, the individuals who attend them are pretty much the same. Okay. And that's one of the problems. That's one of the, you know, key strengths, because, again, it's the cohesive group. But it's also one of the weaknesses, Mark, because, again, when you talk to the same people all the time, you need fresh blood. It's the same, you know, thing when it comes to royal families. You know, if you want to procreate amongst, you know, the degenerates within the royal family, you're going to come to a point where you can have, you know, degenerates being born, you know, generation after generation. That's why you have a lot of the plebes being introduced into the royal family circles, because they just simply need new blood. And the same can be said about these conferences and these meetings. So again, the people are the same. We know from the individuals who attend these conferences, and also individuals who attend, you know, Chatham House meetings, Ford Foundation, you know, Hoover, Hudson, et cetera, et cetera. They're all the same individuals working together. So they're financed by the same people, the same organizations, the same groups.
And I noticed that, Daniel. I noticed that there's a lot of cross-pollination in their networking. A number of Bilderberg members are members of the Trilateral Commission. A number of those Trilat members are members of the Atlantic Council. A number of Atlantic Council members are Brookings Institute members, and the Brookings Institution, as you know, figures pretty strongly into Bilderberg. It seems to me that when Brookings attends Bilderberg or Hudson attends Bilderberg, it's just as important what the name of the organization is, the name of the think tank, as it is who the representative is. In other words, whoever might be attending Bilderberg to represent Brookings, Brookings figures very favorably in the Bilderberg group. So this cross-pollination seems very important, that whatever you might read about the Brookings Institution's agenda will tell you a little something about the Bilderberg agenda.
Well, exactly. You kind of start, you know, putting together as a puzzle. Just to give you an idea how these groups work together. For example, you know, going back to post-Second World War period, late 1940s, early 1950s, to destroy the Soviet Union, over 1,200 institutions in the West worked together to understand Russian and Soviet culture, okay, infiltrate it, and to destroy it from within. And you're looking at a total of over 200,000 people working towards that goal of destroying a nation of 300 million, okay? So needless to say, when you have such organizations as the Bilderbergers and, you know, all these groups such as the, you know, Friends of the Bilderbergers who finance them, they all work. It's a very cohesive group whose objective is, again, to the goal hasn't changed, Mark. You know, if back in the 1940s was destruction of the Soviet Union, now it's, you know, control the world stage, One World Company Limited. Or call it, you know, whatever you want, but the idea hasn't changed. Just, you know, the initials of the organizations might have to a certain point, but again, the people who finance them, their overall objectives haven't changed at all.
Before we summarize, you know, I've covered a few Bilderberg meetings. The last one I covered in person was Austria 2015, and as I watched this, I was somewhat aware that we were reaching some sort of economic impasse. You said impasse was too weak of a word. That you're probably right. What I fear, though, is that because these are the kind of people that built the economic world system 1.0 and economic world system 2.0, and now they're looking for the third time's the charm, what worries me is that they built two failed systems, systems that ultimately failed, and that this hubris is there. In other words, this arrogance that only they can create that third and perfect model. Only the cloistered plutocrats, only these people that live in these rarefied jet set circumstances, only they have the answers. So let's let the people that failed twice build the third system, because they've told themselves that they're the only ones that know how to do this. What I fear is Mad Max from Thunderdome could happen, if for no other reason than the incredible over self-assurance of these people, thinking that they're the only ones that can do this, and that if they don't do it, no one will. I don't believe that to be true, but that's my concern, is that they have too much confidence in themselves, and that if they try and build this third system that's going to avoid this catastrophe, that it'll fail just like the first two did.
Well, except that they're no longer in control, Mark, which is why, again, they lost and Trump won, because Trump represents a different group of people, an alternative group.
Can the Trump group overtake such a deep-seated power structure that goes back, even to the Federal Reserve of 1913? I mean,
Mark, if you look at the people who control the Trump group, you know, their wealth doesn't go back 100 years. Their wealth goes back about 1,000 years. I'll give you an example. In the United States, there was a report.
Well, I didn't mean that the old system, if you want to call it that, I didn't mean their wealth only went back 100 years. I'm going back. I was only tracing some of their institutions. Yes, the money lines go back much further, of course. I mean, the Bank of England was created in 1694 or so, and so on. So I didn't mean that their wealth was limited to 100 years ago, but just go on. I just wanted to clarify that.
The people who are behind Trump, again, it was a couple of years ago, it was a very interesting report put out by a couple of researchers, one American one, I think it was from New Zealand or Australia. And basically what they were able to trace is going back in the United Kingdom to the time of the Richard the Lionheart, that's 1180, that's 837 years ago, that 1% of the population, that's 162,000 people, okay, who are all related to each other, own almost 70% of everything. Okay, and in Western Germany, not Western Germany as in Western and Eastern Germany, but Western part of Germany, 70% of the industry is in the hands of the old Saxon aristocracy. Okay, so as it turned out, it was simply impossible for Trump to lose the elections, because the people behind Trump are infinitely more powerful, okay, than anybody representing the interests of the Clinton or the Rockefeller elite, who are trying to, wrestle the power away from them. And so, again, the people who twice failed at the financial system, they lost power. And they're doing everything in their power to get that power back. But they lost to a group of people who are far more powerful, are far more invisible than anything that I've ever seen. Okay? And that's where we're at today. And the point is that these two systems are diametrically opposite. One represents this globalist, liberal, a banking one model of a central banking warfare model, which has been around for the last 500 years and doesn't work anymore because it's based on infinite growth on a finite planet. And the other group represents, you can talk about the isolationists, you can talk about things based on infrastructure and development. That's one of the reasons why as soon as Trump came in, he immediately started talking about infrastructure, because progress and development.
So in other words, the Trump model, if we can call it that for short, is based more on financial realities and not so speculative.
Exactly. And because, again, progress and development of society is directly proportional to population density. If you can improve technology, you can improve development, you can improve progress on the planet Earth, you're looking at a greater good for everybody. And that, I don't mean that Trump represents us, the people. In no way does he do that. Know the people behind him represent us in any way, shape, or form. What it does mean is simply that at this point in time, okay, the interests of the supranational elite behind Trump, who have been in power for thousands of years, at this time, their interests coincide to a certain point with the interests of 99% of the world's population. In no way, shape, or form am I saying that these people represent the interests of the common man. They will never represent the interests of the common man. They'll want us dead the same way as the other people do. But just right now, they need us more than the other group that represents a different economic model, which doesn't need us. Okay.
So monopoly capitalism of the speculative nature has failed. The economic warfare debt-based model, too reliant on growth, unrealistically connected to growth. So there's this competing system that's behind Trump. It isn't really populist. It isn't really interested in the people's welfare per se.
But you're saying
the interests of the people and the interest of this competing system just happen to converge right now.
At this point, right now, okay. It doesn't mean that it's going to last a long time.
What would you say the window is? Is the window 10 years? Is the window 20 years?
There is no 10 years, period. Even the CIA that used to make 25-year, predictive reports, they're limiting it now to about 5 years. What before it used to, take years, to get to fruition. Now it takes us weeks. You see this whole, accelerated, insanity that we're living through. And the point is that, the time itself has basically shrunk to the, to the minimum common denominator. So we don't have years, We maybe have a year maximum to put together a new model and make it work.
And I'm not expressing my opinion. I'm just asking you for yours. Is this why the media is constantly haranguing Trump, pulling at every nose hair? I mean, literally just picking apart every word, every sentence.
The media represents the elite group that lost power. And they will do everything in their power, media, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, New York, the coasts. They will do everything in their power to get that power back. Because they lost access to the cash. They lost access, to the strings that pull power. So they need to get it back. So they will do everything in their power to get rid of Trump. Lying, stealing, inventing things, blowing things up, using terrorism, nuclear terrorism, whatever you want. Okay, they'll blame it all on Trump. They write it off on Trump. But they'll do anything in their power to get back in power because they represent an alternative model which is dead.
To
get back to power.
Does this mean that Bilderberg is not at its height of strength? In other words, since we're talking about Bilderberg, and we're going to
strength has greatly been diminished.
Why do they keep meeting? I mean, what 1954 every year except 76 during the Lockheed scandal that affected Bernhard, as you know. Why do they keep? I mean, are they just kicking the can down the road now? Are they trying to reorganize? I noticed they brought a lot of younger blood in over the last few years. The Eric Schmidts of the world and the high tech people started showing up. As you say, they need to freshen.
Because it's a change of the model. Because you're going from the warfare model to that model to a new model, which is industry, which is technology, which is networking. Okay, while they're dismantling, and that's again, that's the subject of one of my books called Trans-Evolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, talking about the future of humanity, while they're dismantling the model on the planet Earth, and we are in a financial crisis, the global 2.0, as Catherine Austin Fitz calls it, that's dead. Okay, the money has been stolen, $40, $50 trillion, according to her calculations. Okay, but that money is stolen, it doesn't disappear. Okay, somebody has it, and it's being reinvested into another model. Okay, which is space-based economy. So on the one hand, they're destroying the Earth-based model. But on the other, they're building this interplanetary model. And for that, you need three elements. One, you need the satellites, because in the old days, those who controlled the sea lanes or the empires, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Portuguese, the Dutch, so on and so forth. Today, these sea lane empires are space communication systems. That's why all the great powers launching satellites into space, because you have GPS, you have communications, you have money, etc. And beyond that, you need two other elements. You need a new monetary system, because if you're going to establish an interplanetary civilization, they need a new model which is not based on global control or Earth-based control. And for that, you need new money. You don't need dollars or rubles or euros. You need a new economy, new finances, new money. And that money is going to be digital currency. And for that, you need a new platforms. That's going to be 5G, okay? So the whole model is changing itself, okay, based on a central banking warfare model to a new space-based economy, which is networking 3.0, okay? But that's another story for another day. But there are a lot of challenges ahead for us and for them, okay? They're navigating, very treacherous waters. And again, there are barbarians at the door.
So
they're not going to take too long to come in and eat us alive.
So for the Bilderberg meetings, they're as much in a survival mode and to remain relevant and to keep their...
Definitely survival mode, Mark. You said it well. Definitely a survival mode.
The way you see it. So this neoliberal monopoly capitalist growth for growth's own sake system that they've been pumping
That's dead.
So therefore, if it's dead, then that thereby weakens its parent, or at least one of its chief promoters, that being Bilderberg. So they're going to be in a reinventing mode of their own to kind of reinvent themselves. Because a lot of people ask me, why don't the Bilderbergers just have separate little meetings and communicate through video interchanges and just talk through Skype or whatever? Why do they keep renting out entire hotels? Why do they keep bothering? Michael Meacher, a late UK member of the parliament, you might remember Michael Meacher.
He's in my documentary as well, by the way.
That's great. Cause he told me, Mark, besides the global intrigue you talk about, Bilderberg is a deal-making conference. And he proposed that part of Bilderberg is, if I'm a private corporation owner, high tech or whatever, and I go to Bilderberg and I meet behind closed doors with a foreign finance minister or a foreign central banker, I might make an inside deal that I couldn't make anywhere else. And this is what Michael Meacher said, that Bilderberg is also self-interested. In other words, people there are there to make deals. Is that a
Of course it is. That's always been this way. You know, but it's not only in financial circles. You look at anything that has certain level of importance is not behind closed doors. You're talking about, putting together a lineup for a hockey team, for a basketball playoff. It's all done the same way, as you would see at a financial conference, be it Bilderberg or International Monetary Fund. It's all done behind closed doors.
What I ask before we get into the summarizing for the movie is that. You got the American Friends of Bilderberg registered in New York State as a charity, and their idea of a charity is discussing problems of the Western Alliance, which sounds about as charitable as throwing hammers at a brick wall. And then you've got apparent inside dealing or all the right conditions for inside dealing, bringing kings and kingpins and finance ministers and businessmen and government people, elected government people, former government people, putting them under one roof. How is it that Bilderberg hasn't been busted for either inside trading or presenting themselves falsely as a charity and getting tax deductions or getting tax write-offs illegally? How is it that they've avoided the law in that regard?
Because the law doesn't apply to rich people. Have their own law. The poor people are not protected by the law, and the middle class doesn't exist anymore, Mark.
It's just more indication that government, as we know it, if not being dead, is seriously injured because
it has always been this way. It's not now. It's been this has been the case since the creation of the capitalist model, going back to the discovery of America in 1492. Oh, we can go way, way back, to the ancient Greece or to the ancient Romans or even to the ancient Egyptians. That hasn't really changed all that much either.
Yeah, nevertheless, they appear guilty of alleged or likely insider trading and or charity fraud, tax fraud. I guess, though, that noblesse oblige,
they may very well be, but somebody has to enforce, and if nobody enforces, they're free of charge,
Yeah, get out of jail free card 10 times over. Well, winding up our podcast that could go much longer if we let it, we got to kind of put a rein on this, Daniel, before we go off into the ionosphere, which is easy to do with these Bilderberg chumps, as Tucker used to call them, or Bilderberg boys, he would say out the side of his mouth, and we would laugh ourselves silly. After working 16-hour days covering these guys, I can still recall that. But Daniel Estulin, I appreciate you being with me today. And much more, ladies and gentlemen, can be learned not only in an article that you can read alongside this podcast, but more importantly, in Daniel's new film. What is the actual name of the film, Daniel?
It's called Bilderberg the Movie.
Bilderberg the Movie, and that's going to be Wednesday, May 24, 2017, of course. That's a week from this coming Wednesday, the Prytania Theater, Prytania, at 5339 Prytania Street, New Orleans, Louisiana. I plan to be there with some others. And it's $50, but that includes the movie, an entire book. Yes, you heard me, a book, refreshments, and an after-movie conference or discussion group with Daniel himself. It promises to be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to it to myself. And what is a phone number, Daniel? Do you have something handy?
That's a good one. Hang on a second. Let me just see. I'm looking at the site right now.
At any rate, listeners,
you can call my publisher at. Hang on a second. Just give me one sec. I'll give you the number. Hang on. Okay, it's 1-541-744-0090.
Say it one more time.
541-744-0090. I'm going to send it to you via Skype so you can have it.
That's 541-744-0090. 541-744-0090, correct?
Yeah.
Very good.
Is Chris Milligan.
And as for Chris.
Yeah.
Okay, you heard it here and probably heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen, in this podcast with Daniel Estulin, noted Bilderberg author, researcher, and now documentary maker, just over an hour long. It'll be Wednesday, May 24th. Read all about it. Listen to this podcast. Spread the word. And hopefully it'll be a capacity audience for this most important documentary. I wonder if the local press will pick up on it, Daniel. I don't know if your publishers are going to send a notice out to the local papers.
We do have a lot of interest in the local press. We're actually doing quite a few interviews between now and the next week with local media in New Orleans.
That's very good. That shouldn't be overlooked, because if for no other reason, out of boredom, looking for something fresh, they might put this out there and let people do what they will with it. But Daniel Estulin, thanks for being with me today for this podcast. And you've been listening to me, Mark Anderson, American Fruit Press roving editor, on this podcast for the 15th of May, 2017. We'll see you next time here online.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Daniel.